The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Mike Wallace. Hello, Mike.
Hi there.
Mike, it's been a long time since the last time we had you on the show. That was back in 1999, and at the time we talked about this next book, which has just recently come out. It's called Greater Gotham, A History of New York City from 1898 to 1919, and I think I remember that initially you planned to go a little longer on the chronology, but it looks like you didn't have space. I mean, if you'd made this.
Well, you've got a good memory and you put your finger on it. Originally, the notion was that the second volume in the Gotham series would run down to the end of the Second World War, whereas this book ends in the First World War. We had been hoping, and I had been writing and writing and writing and writing, and when we sat back and looked at what was written and what was projected, we were looking at a 3,000-some-odd page book, which clearly transcended the limits of binary technology and no doubt reader patience. And so we decided on a 2-for-1 stock split. So now the third volume, which will include a lot of material that was intended for the second volume, hopefully will not take another 16 years to produce because a fair amount of it is written already.
You've got a head start. Now I understand, Mike, that initially that you and your co-author on that first volume were planning on writing a history of the USA, but then you decided that was just too big of a task and you decided to look at New York City instead.
Yes, this was foolhardy, but it makes a certain amount of sense given the specifics of that moment. I mean, the nutshell version of the original intention and the background for the Gotham series is the revolution in American history writing that took place in the 60s and the 70s. The 1950s version of American history was extremely benign and extremely limited. There were virtually no women. There was Betsy Ross sewing her flag. And there were virtually no blacks. There was George Washington Carver. He did something with peanuts. And there were the slaves. Yes, we knew about them, but they were happy. And foreign policy, one benignity after another. So when the late 50s and 60s present this narrative with challenges, first of all, the challenges are in the street. Blacks taking the street to demand inclusion in the American present. Women following on demonstrations in the streets demanding equal rights and inclusion in the present, and the anti-Vietnam War struggle, again, inclusion in the present. We historians proceeded in tandem with those social activists to rewrite the history of the United States and to bring back and include the people who had been left out of the official picture. And we were going to do it for the entire U.S. of A., partly because I was very much involved with a network of historians who were organizing and promoting this process of reinterpretation. And from where I sat, I could see that, to my eye, it looked as if 10 years of work had, by hundreds of scholars, had effectively rewritten the history, but nobody knew it because what was missing was a overview, a narrative that put all these pieces together and made something available for a general audience. So I set out to do that. I enlisted Ted Burroughs, a colleague at Brooklyn College. We wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages. And we hadn't gotten out of the 17th century, deciding, therefore, that this was going to take about 11 lifetimes. We only had two. After a period of deep depression, I thought, well, let's just decant all this stuff and tackle something more manageable, only the history of New York City. So we kind of crept up on the itself formidable project because it was conceived as a downshift from a preposterous project. And Gotham is the result.
And that first book, which came out almost 20 years ago, was a monumental book and was recognized as such. You won the Pulitzer Prize for it. And the second book, I'll tell you, after reading it for the last couple of months and sitting in bed, I was so glad when I got to the middle because it kind of balanced the weight. You know, I could set it down and I didn't have to hold it up in my hands. I mean, my arms were literally sore.
Yes. Well, there are people who try to figure out ways to read it on the beach, read it on airplanes. There's all sorts of ingenuity has been inspired by this, although many trees have died that these volumes might live.
I'm not an e-book reader, but I was tempted. I thought if this is available as an electronic book, I might actually have to consider reading it that way.
Because I'm a big fan of e-books,
are
I
you?
Must say. Although what I like about Volume 2 here is that it's a beautiful book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that could be captured by an e-version. There's about 300-odd graphics in there, and unlike most New York City books, which recycle the same 50 images over and over and over and over again, we really dug in deep. And plus, so many things are now more available and accessing on the Internet. And the paper is heavyweight. It's not magazine quality, but images are really very, very nicely done. So I don't know if there's such a thing called bookiness. this is an advertisement for it.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Mike Wallace. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And Mike recently published the second volume in the history of New York City. It's called Greater Gotham, A History of New York City from 1898 to 1919. And I agree with you about the imagery in this book. Sometimes I would get to a picture and I would just stop and look at it for a long time. One that I'm thinking of right now is the one of a dead horse lying in the street with a bunch of little boys.
Yeah, it really gets the point across, doesn't it?
I had never seen that image. So many of these I had never seen. We could talk about this book for hours and hours and hours and barely skim the surface. Let's talk about the structure. How did you decide to set it up the way that you did?
Well, I thought there were several dimensions that I wanted to focus on. First one was consolidation, because the founding event of 1898 is the merger of New York and Brooklyn and scores of little political jurisdictions around the harbor of New York City. So the creation of what is today New York dates only to 1898.
Mm.
And the second thing that followed from that, I mean, I can explain what the roots of that whole merger operation were, and they're important. But once a megalopolis of that dimension had been created on paper, it was necessary to make it a reality on the ground. And so I looked at the building out, really, of the infrastructure, of the population, of housing, of sewer lines, of bridges, et cetera, all that mechanical stuff. And then I argued that while from this first perspective, the city had seemed an unqualified success, but if you added, or if you looked at it with a different set of lenses, a different set of metrics, measuring the degree of social justice attained, the availability of social goods like housing and health care and the like, then it was not up to the snuff that one wanted, particularly working people, women, blacks. So it was an investigation used to call history from the bottom up, as well as history from the top down. And it was in the merger of those two things, as it were, that you get the full dynamics of the situation. And then finally, there's a last section on the First World War, a momentous event with tremendous impact on the city in a variety of ways. So those are the three bold structural components, each of them many hundreds of pages in length.
There are so many personalities, so many people that flip through these pages. But I think if I had to pick one person who during this period just keeps coming back and coming back, that would be the man who was governor of New York and then president during this period, Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, Teddy Roosevelt is a colossal figure. By the way, we know exactly how many people have traipsed through its pages. The names index includes 1,632 entries. And Teddy is a larger-than-life figure. And, I mean, to really understand Roosevelt and his reputation and his impact, you've got to put it in the context of what the merger movement is, of which he was a small player, but he was a big player in terms of the aftermath of it. What I focused on in this volume was the impact of people like J.P. Morgan, people like John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, all the big names, too casually called the Robert Barons, are too easy. What made them powerful and influential in a variety of ways was their analysis of the state of the American economy, of American capitalism itself. They thought it was going dogs. And it was tremendously damaged by an excess of competition. They may have cited competition as a good thing on 4th of July parades, but in reality, businessmen hated competition, and certainly the big guys did. Why? Because if you have cutthroat competition between firms, you have to cut your prices. If you cut your prices, you cut your profits. If you cut your profits, you got to make them up somehow, so you cut wages. If you cut wages, unions emerge. If you crush the unions, and there was a lot of crushing going on in the 1890s, then socialists pop up and challenge the entire capitalist order. This is insane as far as Morgan and Rockefeller argued. And their solution was to wring as much competition out of the macroeconomy as they possibly could, which they did with tremendous speed. Between 1898 and 1904, the first great merger wave in American economic history took place. And thousands of competing small companies were merged into hundreds of gigantic super corporations on the order of United States Steel, General Electric, AT&T, and all of the above. And it wasn't that they were doing this just to make money, although they made pots of money off the process. It was that they were hoping to inject a note of rationality, of long-term planning, of increasing stability, of moderating the tremendous surges up and down, boom, bust. They would reconstruct American capitalism itself, and its headquarters was New York City. And its central physical manifestation was the skyscraper, where not only were giant office worker complexes established, but corporations advertised their brand, registering it in the sky over Manhattan with distinctive rooftops and architecture. So this concentration of economic muscle was also scary for a lot of people. Among them, Roosevelt. Roosevelt's a very contradictory guy. I mean, on one hand, he and Morgan and Rockefeller are all New Yorkers, and they know each other from the old days. And Roosevelt, in particular, was an aristocrat, unlike the Johnny-come-latelys of the Morgans and the Rockefellers. He goes way back in New York history. And he kind of looked down on these money people. They weren't cultivated and cultured like he was, and he was. He wrote lots of books, and he read God knows how many more. He was an intellectual as well as a political figure. And his vision was these corporations have got too damn much power, and they've got so much money that they can influence the political system itself, and they did. They poured money in incredible amounts in 1896. The two guys, Rockefeller and Morgan alone, contributed $500,000. This was when a million, which was the combined total of all the campaign funding that the Democratic William Jimmy Tryon was able to get the hold of. So Teddy wants a system where the political system puts limits on the corporate system, but doesn't overturn it. There are people who want to disaggregate, dismantle, take apart the giant corporations. Roosevelt says no, that they're an historical advance, but they've got to be curtailed. And so he goes back and forth himself on too much, too little, too much, too little. That's an intricate dance, which in fact I try to capture.
In case you just joined us, my guest is Mike Wallace, and we're discussing the second volume of his History of New York City. It's called Greater Gotham, A History of New York City from 1898 to 1919. As I read it, I'm sure I'm like a lot of readers. For one thing, I was very impressed with your ability to make this so accessible. I think that anybody who reads this is going to go, wow, this is just so readable. This isn't dense, hard to understand history. This is just right here for me to enjoy. And there's so many parts of it where I read it and I said to myself, okay, I'm going to look at this and then I'm going to think about New York today. Like, I thought about all these rich people and how New York was a city of millionaires, which we think of Manhattan now as a city of millionaires. But man, these guys talk about excess. Throwing dinner parties where they're sitting on horseback at the dinner party. I mean, this is just insane.
Yes. Well, I mean, you've used several words there, Richard, near and dear to my heart. One of them is enjoy, and the other is readable. I don't think there's been so far a single review of the dozens or so that hasn't actually used the word readable. I think partly it's a function of not being able to believe that you can read hundreds of pages and not die of exhaustion or boredom or collapse from sheer weight of things. Because it is, in fact, written as closely as is possible in the form of a novel. That there are characters are admittedly whisked on and off the stage in their profusion of numbers, but part of the reason that it keeps moving along and people enjoy reading it is that it never gets ahead of itself. So, you know, if there's a depression that breaks out in 1907, and you could say nearly as bad as the 1929, which was coming up, because there is no coming up in this book. People in the book are all in their present and their past. If they think about the future, it's their hopes and fears. But there's no authorial intervention. So, I mean, that's an academic apparatus which I've dropped. And I've followed the... I mean, the second thing is that academics properly investigate different aspects of history in grooves, in channels. So there's military history, architectural history, gender history, black history, et cetera, et cetera. This is sensible because you develop esprit de corps, you have contests of opinion and interpretation, double-checking on the facts, developing a language that's sophisticated to the tools that you need. So that makes sense, but it's not the way life is lived. Life happens all at once. All the banking and sewer systems and sexuality and poetry. And the people who really do that the best are novelists. they embed all of this richness in particular people and tell their stories. Mm. That's really more or less what I've tried to do. I rest on the shoulders, the many, many, many shoulders of the specialist historians who have plumbed this, that, and the other aspect of things, and then try to merge them together and keep them moving and with a light touch. I must say, every now and then when I'm panicky and I think, oh, my God, have I just committed too many pages? And I open the book at random, and I read the page, and there's virtually, it's hard to find a page which doesn't somehow or another bring a smile to your face,
mm-hmm.
Or even occasionally a chortle.
Mike, I have so many favorite sections and so many favorite personalities that I could barely even begin to talk about them. But I would like to mention a couple of them and have you talk about those. And one of the ones that really stood out to me was your chapter on repressives and the gangs of New York. And at first when you mentioned the one time these guys all got together was on Election Day, I said to myself, what's he mean? And then you explained it.
Yes, Monk Eastman and Paul Kelly and their compeers were the midpoint of an interesting trajectory in the relationship between crime and politics in New York City. In the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, when Tammany Hall, Democratic Party, and Whig Party were fighting one another, each of them would bring muscle men. They'd hire lowlifes to come and seize control of the polls. So you'd get polling places where it was a uniform, total 100% vote for the X party or the Y party, because they had their muscle boys preventing anybody from who looked like they were likely to not support you from the polls. But they were definitely under the thumb of the politicians. In this period, the early 20th century, the gangsters are getting much bigger, much stronger, more commercially minded, really. They issue lists of things that they're prepared to provide in the violence category. So breaking an arm is X dollars, and doing the big job is considerably more costly.
Uh-huh.
And peeking ahead, which I don't do in the book because it would violate my rules, but peeking ahead, you're looking at the degree to which in the 1930s and 40s the gangsters became, or certainly became, dominant in the political arena. And Tammany was to some extent under the thumb of Lucky Luciano and the Sordid Company. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things that I keep an eye on in each time period. And for people with long memories like you do, they'll remember the first time they read about gangsters. Now, here's the theme again, but it's a new configuration of power.
I think one of my favorite personalities that I'd heard her name, but I didn't really know much about her, is Sophie Tucker. What an interesting woman.
Yeah, Sophie's one of my favorite people. Sophie is interesting in so many ways, but what she's notoriously famous for is introducing sexuality into lyrics, double entendres, admittedly. But in a funny way. And the second thing that she was noted for was her understanding of the racist dimension of the popular art form, musical form of the day, which were called coon songs, which were descendants from minstrel shows, which had white people dressing up in blackface, mimicking their fantasies of what black people did and saying things with blackface on that they wouldn't have dared say in their own skin. Sophie starts off wearing blackface and doing routines, but she got very popular. She traveled to the South. She met lots of black people and discover that this is an outrageous canard that they've been perpetrating, you know, chicken stealing, watermelon eating, and that it was profoundly racist. And she stopped wearing blackface, and she stopped doing coon songs, and shifted into gender issues, which were, again, just perfectly timed with things that were happening in the larger gender order. And partly it was her own appearance. She was a Zoftig beauty. I forget exactly how much she weighed in it, but it was substantial, which in a sense allowed her to get away with humorous sexual innuendo singing that if you had been a sexy beauty would have been taken in that period as, you know, trashy. And thirdly, and last, she was there at the birth of jazz. I mean, she goes from vaudeville to the musical stage at just the moment, and in conjunction with people like the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and was a cultural, political, racial, and sexual pioneer. She was a piece of work.
One of the many fascinating characters in this amazing second volume of Mike Wallace's History of New York City, Greater Gotham, published by Oxford University Press. And as I read it, of course, I kept thinking about what's going on today. When I read about the murder of Stanford White in Madison Square Garden, I immediately thought about all the sex scandals that we're hearing about right now, and his predilection for young women, and just what a womanizer he was. That reminded me of our current times. And when I read about this unfortunate soul, Oda Benge, or Benji, I thought about all the racial issues that we're dealing with today, and just a fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, the book is obviously written by somebody who's living in this period. So historians tend to ask questions that are present in the air around them. You don't go back and adopt the sensibility of somebody who was alive at that point. And that's a legitimate thing to do, but it's not what I do.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that these things are important and are going to be have descendants, but I never say it. And astute readers like yourself can't help but notice these things. But one doesn't want to too quickly attribute causation or a direct line of movement from Stanford White's day till now, the world in which he operated during the one that Maxim Gorky got caught up in, another contemporary gender escapade, were of a period, of a moment. They were a response to existing forces and configurations of power. And things are very different now. So, yes, it's important and it's legitimate to look back and think about lineages, but one doesn't want to get too caught up in analogies if it leads to disrespecting the historical specificity of the past.
Sure. Even Twain was scandalized by Gorky. Well, I see we've eaten up our time here, Mike, and I know you've got to catch a plane to Miami. It's really been a pleasure having you back on the program. I hope we don't have to wait another 19 years for the next one.
I fervently hope the same.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. The book is Greater Gotham, A History of New York City from 1898 to 1919, and my guest has been Mike Wallace. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis.